5 minutes later, the yellow circle labelled Mirror pulled out into the street and began traversing slowly north. Shelley Noakes reduced the scale of the map until her own circle, a gently pulsing blue, appeared at the edge of the screen, and watched the yellow disc advance imperceptibly upon the blue for almost 30 seconds, before turning off the phone and throwing it suddenly and childishly into the pile of laundry at the end of her bed. Mira would not be home for half an hour at least, but already Shelley's heart was beating fast, and the skin of her throat and breast had mottled. She stood up, breathing deeply, and tempted herself with the thought that perhaps today was not the day to broach the subject after all. But then she heard Mira's voice in her head, telling her that there was a voice in her head, and that the voice was her mother's. Shelley's mother was one of the pet topics of conversation at Burnham Wood. Having estranged herself to Mira early in their acquaintance by referring to the collective as a hobby, and to her daughter's involvement with it as a phase. Mira had taken such instant and lasting umbrage at these remarks that Shelley had begun to fear there must be something wrong with her, that she herself had taken no offence at all. And although she had now given more than 4.5 years to Burnham Wood, she did not consider this to be a reproof of her mother's early lack of faith in her, for she felt more surprised than anyone that she had stuck it out so long. Mira could not understand this. She was not given to casual self-deprecation, and was convinced that Shelley had been either bullied or brainwashed out of a more natural self-belief. The irony, of course, which Shelley had only fully grasped in retrospect, was that a gently deprecating sense of humour was actually one of the things that Shelley most liked about herself, and one of the things, it had to be said, that she most loved about her mother. Mrs. Noakes was a recruitment consultant who believed that the world's population could be divided into those with a gift for sales and those with a gift for service. Most people, she was fond of remarking, were employed against their type, and if they would only take a good honest look at themselves and determine into which of the two categories they fell, they might save the rest of us a lot of fuss and bother. When Mira had first heard this, she'd laughed, listing, with no small relish, all the ways that selling was a service and all the ways that services were sold. She had dismissed the maxim as vapid neoliberal bullshit, adding, with careless perspicacity, that Mrs. Noakes appeared to compete with her children in several arenas, but most particularly on the issue of job satisfaction, a hard-won prize for the women of her generation, and one that she was unwilling, perhaps, to share. Shelley could recall it almost word for word. She had been 21 years old to Mira's 24, and never in her life had she heard any adult criticised so openly and calmly, without any of the usual forms of obeisance, the ritual admission of the speaker's likely ignorance, the ritual deference to all opposing points of view, that for her was so thoroughly ingrained that they inhibited her thinking as severely as they did her speech. She had sought out Mira's friendship with a fervour that approached infatuation, transforming herself, though she would not realise this until years later, into a more perfect image of the person that Mira had told her she already was. More benighted, more oppressed, and more continually in conflict with a mother whose every utterance, she came to discover, incarnated no less an enemy than the spectre of late capitalism itself. Cast virtually since birth in the role of the family peacemaker, and praised throughout her adolescence for having cost her parents not a single night of sleep, Shelley had lived for as long as she could remember in perpetual dread of being dislikable, a fate even more terrible than being disliked, for it encompassed not only her relationships with others, but her private judgments of herself. It was only under Mira's influence that she learned, if not to overcome this terror, then at least to direct the blame for it elsewhere. She returned to the pile of laundry and checked her phone again. The yellow circle had crossed the avenue that marked the border of the central city and was drawing level with a planted flag that, on Shelley's map, was labelled Site 15. It slowed as it approached the turnoff and seemed to be on the verge of stopping. "I went already," Shelley said aloud, and as if Mira had heard her, the circle seemed to change its mind and carried on, picking up speed again. Shelley had a creepy feeling. She shut off the screen a second time and plugged the phone into the wall to charge, stabbing the cord into the socket with more force than was necessary, and willing herself not to touch it again before Mira got home, not even if she heard it buzzing. Shelley had been deciding between a diploma in library information studies and a diploma in high school teacher training, when she had first encountered Mira planting seedlings in the dirt. She was only 15 credits short of the 360 needed to complete her bachelor's degree, majoring in English and specializing in 20th century genre fiction, for which she had accrued $23,000 in debt. But within a fortnight, she had dropped her final paper, Popular Teen Fantasy and Its Representation on Film, blighting her academic record with the first failing grade of her life, and placing both diplomas, for the time being at least, out of reach. Her mother could not comprehend it, and flouted her own dictum by prescribing a few months' work in the thankless world of retail to set her daughter back on a sensible path. She was unable to accept that Burnham Wood might answer what she saw as Shelley's natural gift for service, for she could not see what higher purpose a frankly illegal scheme of trespassing and botanical vandalism could possibly hope to serve, either for Shelley or for anybody else. Or so she was imagined to believe. At Burnham Wood, Shelley's mum had become a kind of shorthand for the many evils of the baby boomer generation, a despised cohort of hoarders and plunderers from which Mira's own parents, who had recently separated, always seemed mysteriously to be exempt. Nor was Shelley's dad of any interest to Mira as an adversary. He was a mortgage broker with an irritable disposition, who was always, in the family parlance, in a rage. An infirmity openly encouraged, as Mira pointed out, by his wife, who indeed devoted an unusual proportion of her daily conversation to reminding her husband of the many kinds of people in the world whom he disliked. That this list, which included vegans, slow walkers, loudmouths, ostentatious breastfeeders, people of indeterminate gender, buskers, bad drivers, and the unwashed, covered in one way or another the entire membership of Burnham Wood, Mira did not appear to find insulting. She saw Shelley's father as a creature of his wife's devising, not an autonomous adult, but a hapless pawn designed by Mrs. Noakes for the solitary purpose of throwing her own, more vivid personality into greater relief. A plainly narcissistic exercise of which she, Mira, could not remotely see the appeal. Only years later had Shelley thought to place the long and penetrating conversations of the early months of their friendship in the context of Mira's parents' separation, which dated, she eventually learned, from the morning of the day that she and Mira had first met. From Mira's brief account of the scene, it had taken place over breakfast, her father standing behind her mother's chair and massaging her shoulders tenderly as she relayed the news. It would seem that her parents had arrived at their decision so amicably and mutually, and with such happy consciousness, both of the wonderful years they'd spent together and of the exciting possibilities that now lay ahead, as to make redundant any further examination of either the meaning of their choice or its potential consequences for anyone involved. Mira could talk about other people's relationships endlessly. She freely confessed that she liked nothing better. But when she talked about her own, it was always in a tone of brisk, semi-exasperated satire that gave the impression she had exhausted the subject a long time ago and felt no impatience to revive it. For the first few months of their friendship, all that Shelley had known about Mira's parents had been that they were former hippies who had each stood for their local constituency, her mother for the Green Party, her father for Labour, in subsequent elections, without success, and that Mira's mother had a son from a previous relationship, Mira's half-brother Rufus, who was the lead guitarist in a touring rock band, and whom Mira's father apparently adored. They sounded wonderfully enlightened, and the fact that Mira saw them only intermittently, Shelley took as further proof of the psychological maturity that Mira found wanting in everybody else. She began to feel embarrassed that her own family convened each week for their parochial Sunday lunch, where invariably the conversation centered on, and was directed at, the dog. And she was even more embarrassed whenever Mira asked to tag along. Mira always behaved politely and engagingly at the table, praising the cooking and helping with the washing up. She barely mentioned Burnham Wood, except to narrate the odd family-friendly anecdote and the humorous and confidential mode of speech that she always used when speaking to adults. But to Shelley, the occasions were unbearable. Every detail an appalling indictment of her family's mediocrity, every word spoken an appalling desecration of Mira's deeply held beliefs. She was still too much in Mira's thrall to suspect her of any emotion so ordinary as loneliness, or so shallow as envy. And it was a relief, walking home, to return to the central theme of their friendship by cataloguing, freshly, all the many ways in which Shelley's mother was in need of reform. If Mrs. Noakes knew how unsparingly she was anatomized, then she possessed more fortitude of character than either Mira or her daughter ever diagnosed. For despite her initial resistance to Shelley's sudden change of course, and despite her frequent sharing of career vacancy advertisements, just to give you a sense of what's out there, Mrs. Noakes had really come around to Burnham Wood. In fact, it pained Shelley to admit, when her mother spoke about it now, it was with real pride and admiration. The political rout of 2016 had brought with it a new mood of deference towards the radically unforeseen. Around the globe, forecasters had been chastened and experts maligned. In their place had come the disruptors, the technological imperialists, the metadata millenarians and stokers of popular feeling who had managed, invisibly and hitherto impossibly, to manufacture the authentic, the world's most influential brand. A new vocabulary had come into force. Burnham Wood was now a startup, a pop-up, the brainchild of creatives. It was organic, it was local. It was a bit like Uber, it was a bit like Airbnb. In this new, perpetually unsettled climate, Shelley's defection from the conventional economy had gained, she knew, a kind of retroactive valour. And even Mira, seditious, independent-minded Mira, suddenly seemed to be just the sort of trendy, big-talking renegade one could imagine being contracted by the government as a black ops advisor, writing inflammatory blogs and newspaper columns that defended unorthodox opinions and debated the right to free speech. Agitation had lost its juvenile cast. It had been made urgent again, righteous again, necessary again. An aura of prescience now permeated Burnham Wood. And Shelley wanted out. Out of the group, out of the suffocating moral censure, the pretended fellow feeling, the constant obligatory thrift, out of financial peril, out of the flat, out of her relationship with Mira, which was not romantic in any physical sense, but which had somehow come to feel both exclusive and proprietary. And above all, out of her role as the sensible, dependable, predictable sidekick, never quite as rebellious as Mira, never quite as free-thinking, never, even when they acted together, quite as brave. She wanted out with a force of feeling that was as abrupt and absolute as when she had first known she wanted in. And when she probed the conviction, she found that she could not explain the reason for her disenchantment any more clearly than she could explain what had so powerfully attracted her to Burnham Wood in the first place. And even more, she found that she did not want to explain it, did not want to understand it, did not want to subject to scrutiny that awful buried certainty that whatever she did or said, however she acted, whatever life she chose, she would always be wrong, ill-intended, ill-prepared and incomplete. On a dark and shameful level of her consciousness, Shelley knew that the drastic course corrections in her life, her phases, to use the word that Mira so deplored, did not owe to any sudden clarities of vision or vocation, but to this smothered and ever-present sense of dread. She had tried to escape it by joining Burnham Wood, and she was trying to escape it now. But she would never escape it, because she could not feel the difference, could not understand the difference between running towards something and running away. Her phone buzzed, and she looked over to read the notification that had lit the screen, craning from where she stood so as not to break her promise not to touch it. The message was a promotional email from a hotel where she had once logged on to the lobby Wi-Fi. "Last chance to save," read the subject line. Shelley's heartbeat had surged again. Miserably, she put her hand to her throat to quell the pounding and stared at the device until the screen went dark and the image was replaced by a hash of oily streaks and fingerprints marking all the places she had scrolled and tapped and liked and pinned and maximized and minimized and forwarded and binned and sent. To break up with a friend was difficult enough, but she and Mira shared far more and had committed far more than ordinary friends. And for all that Shelley had tried to reassure herself that she desired nothing more exotic or exceptional than an independent income, a chance at self-fulfillment, and a change of scene, she knew, and she felt sick even to acknowledge it, that Burnham Wood would likely not survive without her. After 5 years of operation, the collective was still nowhere near the point of self-sufficiency that they jokingly referred to as breaking good. Without her contributions, that dream would recede even further. Mira would have to take over the accounting and schedule planning, fields in which she was almost comically unskilled. She would have to find a new flatmate, and possibly a new flat. She would have to train Shelley's replacement, not just over months, but over years, for each season brought its unique challenges and opportunities, and each crop behaved in a different way. And all of this, Shelley thought in disgusted outrage at herself, all of this would take up time that Mira did not have to spare. The project would be forced to downscale, members would lose interest and disband, and Mira's ambitions would be crushed. Feeling despicably, preposterously selfish, Shelley went outside to turn the compost heap and rehearse what she was going to say. Officially, the group cultivated 18 plots of land around the city, some in the gardens of care homes and preschools, one bordering the car park of a surgery and dental practice, and most in the yards of rented student flats. In exchange for access to their space and use of their mains water, the hosts received half the yield of every crop. The rest of the harvest went to the members, either to consume among themselves or to pack in boxes to give to the needy, or to sell on the side of the road beneath a sign that claimed, with some creative license, that the produce was homegrown. In accordance with their charter, they spent any income they earned only on seeds, soil, and whatever equipment could not be bartered or salvaged from the tip. Nobody received wages, and all assets were commonly held. Membership, as a result, was almost entirely a part-time affair. And even Mira, who stayed perpetually enrolled at university in order to draw down the student allowance and yearly bursary for course-related costs, was occasionally obliged to seek temporary employment. Several times Shelley had raised the possibility of launching a subscription service, a monthly box of produce collated from all their growing sites and delivered door-to-door, so as to afford the group a little more stability in planning. But despite general interest, it had never come to pass. The problem was not just that they had never quite reached that point of critical mass where their income would finally exceed their many costs and liabilities. It was that breaking good, for Mira at least, had always meant more than simply breaking even. Her ambition for Burnham Wood was nothing less than radical, widespread, and lasting social change, which would be entirely achievable, she was convinced, if only people could be made to see how much fertile land was going begging, all around them, every day, and how much more could be accomplished in the world if everybody simply pooled their knowledge and resources, and how arbitrary and absurdly prejudicial the entire concept of land ownership, when divorced from use or habitation, really was. The difficulty, of course, was in knowing whether it was better to raise public consciousness through protest and risk putting off those very people who were yet to be converted to the cause, or to risk accusations of hypocrisy and try to change the system from within. And here, Mira never really gave a settled answer. Temperamentally, two factions existed within Burnham Wood. The ideologues, who were combative and self-conscious, and who cherished revolutionary aims. And the do-gooders, who were more reliably hard-working, but who were also, in a way, more hard work, being more fixated than the ideologues on the ways in which any breaches of protocol ought to be policed. Mira didn't fall wholly into either contingent, but the fact that the ideological faction had dwindled over the years was a source of great shame and consternation to her, and sometimes Shelley wondered if her patent lack of interest in the financial viability of Burnham Wood was her way of reassuring herself, even unconsciously, that she had not sold out. Mira had a peculiar relationship with money. She was uninterested in profit, and at the same time obsessed by growth, and she opposed most mainstream economic policy, not only on moral terms, but also on the grounds that it was imaginatively limiting. Unusually for someone of her politics, she was untouched by depression. Her convictions were the sort that required a sparring partner, rather than of the sort that required a cure. She could be impulsively, even alarmingly, generous, and never seemed to second-guess, as Shelley did, the things she sold or gave away. But she was also wildly inconsistent. That the university, for example, had never once made contact to ask the reason for her continued non-attendance, she saw as proof of a rapacious business model that, in her opinion, had so utterly debauched a university's fundamental reasons for existence as to justify almost any act of civil disobedience against it. But that she herself had effectively come to treat that institution not as a hallowed place of learning, but as a financial instrument, she considered to be merely fitting. She was untroubled, or at least claimed to be untroubled, that her student record showed only failures for the last 3 years. And although her student loan was now in excess of $100,000, she avowed that the debt did not remotely worry her, because she had no intention of ever paying it back. In any case, a great deal of what they needed could be got for free, if not from the natural world, then by raiding skips and recycling bins, by making collections of unwanted household junk, or simply by asking for donations. Shelley had learned from Mira the particular clairvoyance of the scavenger, whereby discarded items now appeared to her only in the form of something else. Old window screens were shade cloth, flattened cardboard and carpet cutoffs were weed matting. Plastic bottles, when sliced in half, became little cloches to fit over seedlings to keep them warm. Any receptacle could be a seed tray, and anything reflective could be propped against it to maximize the light. She had discovered over the years that the more peculiar her requests, the more eager people seemed to meet them. Clippings from hair salons for slug repellent, old tights to fit over the heads of cabbages and cauliflowers to protect them from pests, wool to drape cat's cradle over plantings to deter the birds. Every windowsill of the tiny flat that she and Mira shared was occupied by rows and rows of seedlings, and they recorded each successive planting in the open source folder shared among the members, that kept track of all the interlocking schedules of weeding, watering, and cultivation, advertised what jobs needed doing, recorded where tools were being stored, and disclosed how any income had been spent. That was the official face of Burnham Wood, the one they wore when recruiting members and soliciting prospective hosts. In truth, however, a great deal of what they harvested had been planted without permission on public or unattended lands. They chose hardy perennials, fast-growing annuals, or, if the ground was tilled enough, root crops that might from a distance be confused for weeds, and sowed them along verges and fence lines, beside motorway off-ramps, inside demolition sites, and in junkyards filled with abandoned cars. To avoid detection, they tended these guerrilla plantings in the very early morning, or, when in daylight, wearing high-vis, to give the appearance of an authenticated scheme. Water posed the biggest challenge, being too heavy to transport in any volume. A 20-litre water cooler bottle strapped to the back of a bicycle was too memorable a sight to risk with any regularity. And although they had experimented with drip irrigators fashioned out of finely perforated plastic vessels, these also had the disadvantage of drawing the eye. They had better luck collecting rainwater, dredging ponds and rivers, and tapping private spigots and irrigation booms, where, in the event that they were apprehended, they took care never to identify themselves, or Burnham Wood, by their real names. Shelley was not a natural liar, and no matter how minimally or justifiably they trespassed, she could never fully shake the dread of being caught. This was rare, but when it happened, all of Mira's reasonings, that they were only reaping what they themselves had sown, that they were giving to the soil and to the air at least as much as they were taking from it, that a good proportion of their harvest was destined for the needy, and, in anarchistic moments, that after all the landowners had committed theft on a far greater scale, simply by virtue of being landowners, deserted her, and she became too mortified even to speak. It would fall to one of the other members to deploy one of several plausible fictions they had devised in order to be able to stall an inquisitor for long enough that they could get away. And they did more than trespass. Their plantings occasionally choked out local competition or became so prolific as to be expensive to remove. Sometimes they returned to a site to find it had been doused in weed killer or burned. They took cuttings from suburban gardens, leaf litter out of public parks, and manure from farmland. Mira had stolen scions from commercial apple orchards, budding wisps of Braeburn and Royal Gala that she grafted to the stalks of sour crabapple trees, and equipment out of unlocked garden sheds, though only, she insisted, in wealthy neighborhoods, and only those tools that did not seem to be in frequent use. But she prized her freedom too highly to ever risk it very far, and she was careful to conceal any patently criminal activity from the wider membership of Burnham Wood, whose good opinion she was anxious to retain. That, Shelley thought, as she forked the compost and released the sweet vegetal stink into the air, had been her own most valuable contribution to the group over the years. Through the sheer unlikelihood of her allegiance, she gave Mira the only kind of credibility she lacked, the ordinary. in playing the supporting role not as a disciple or a fanatic, but as a foil. She not only tempered Mira's image, she had ensured, that the hidden face of Burnham Wood stayed underground. She heard a crunch of gravel behind her and turned in surprise, for even with a tailwind, Mira could not possibly have made it home so soon. But the person coming down the driveway was a tanned, bearded man of around 30, slightly round-shouldered, his long hair swept back from his forehead, and his thumbs tucked under the straps of his backpack. He was wearing a tartan scarf and a misshapen woolen coat, both of which looked emphatically second-hand.
"Hi," he said. "I'm looking for Mira. Bunting."
Shelley stared at him.
"Tony?"
"Oh, shit," he said.
He was shorter than she remembered, and his tan made his blue eyes seem bluer.
"Shelley," she reminded him. "Shelley Noakes."
"God," he said. "I'm really sorry. I guess it's been a while."
But his face was flushed. It was plain that he still did not recognize her, and that he was now desperately searching his memory for even the smallest piece of information about her, because the name hadn't helped. To prompt him, Shelley said,
"You left right after I joined up."
Kindly, for in fact they had overlapped by several months.
"Few years ago now."
"Yeah, God,
you were headed overseas."
"That's it," he said,
looking hunted.
"I only just got back."
"It was a teach abroad type thing, wasn't it? Somewhere in South America."
His blush intensified.
"Mexico," he said. "Technically north. But yeah, pretty great. Thought I'd never come home, actually."
"I bet."
He glanced at the house, still flushed.
"It's weird to be back. Everything's the same, and everything's different. You know?"
"I bet,"
Shelley said again.
"This looks amazing, though."
He made a gesture that incorporated the compost heap, the polytunnels, and the potting bench.
"I heard it's all still going strong."
"Yeah,"
she said, looking around as well.
"Santa's workshop."
"Exactly,"
he said and laughed. He looked relieved.
"You live with Mira?"
"Yeah," Shelley said. "I did back then as well. We moved into the Hanson's Lane flat just before you left. About a month before."
There was a slight pause.
"I remember your leaving party was pretty wild," she said.
"Hey," he said. "Look, I'm really sorry."
"Nah," she said, waving him away. "I'm just making you feel bad."
"Well, if I can't, I mean, clearly I was a massive dick back then."
"Steady on," she said. "Bigger than average, maybe. I wouldn't have said massive."
"Oh, Jesus,"
he said, putting his hands on his head.
"Okay, you're messing with me."
She grinned at him.
"And didn't I lend you some money? Like, quite a bit of money?"
"Yeah, you know, I think I did. And you never paid me back." Now he was smiling too.
"You're really enjoying this, aren't you?"
"It's a very powerful position," Shelley said. "I don't want to waste it."
She almost didn't recognize herself. The adrenaline she'd built up in rehearsing for her confrontation with Mira was allowing her to speak and act in ways that were utterly unlike her. She felt at once both dangerously reckless and dangerously calm. The normal Shelley would have been horrified on his behalf, would have apologized for being so thoroughly forgettable, would have reassured him that she had no expectation whatsoever of his remembering anything about her, since it was a long time ago, and their friendship had been so fleeting, and those days were such a blur. The normal Shelley would have teased him, in a tone of sisterly indulgence, that back then he had been so patently in love with Mira, and everyone had known it, that it was only natural that his memory would be distorted. Of course, it would make perfect sense if the only thing he could remember from that time was her. In the spirit of their shared affections, and to put him even further at ease, the normal Shelley might even have confided that although she shouldn't really be the one to tell him this, for Mira, he had always been the one who got away. But she did not feel normal. A solution had occurred to her, an exit strategy so clean and absolute that it was almost bloodless.
She would sleep with Tony. She would sleep with Tony, and she would confess what she had done to Mira, and Mira would not be able to forgive her. There would be no need for any confrontation, no need for apologies and tearful explanations and long arguments late into the night. There would be nothing to say. There would be only the fact of her betrayal, which Mira would not be able to forgive. And whether Shelley would then leave Burnham Wood of her own volition, or because Mira demanded it, would scarcely matter. She would sleep with Tony, and after that, leaving would not be something she was asking for, but something she had already done.
"Is she home?" Tony said. "I didn't call ahead or anything."
"She'll be out for another couple of hours," Shelley said, the lie coming easily. She didn't break eye contact. She didn't blush. "Hey," she added naturally, as if the thought had just occurred to her, "do you want to go somewhere and get a drink?" He hesitated, but it was clear that he owed it to her, and he could hardly say that he was otherwise engaged. In her new and preternatural confidence, Shelley had no fear that he would turn her down. She was going to sleep with him. Tonight.
"Sure," he said, very reluctantly.
"Yeah, let's do it."
"Great," said Shelley. "Just let me go and grab my phone."